morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We are also podcasting. The website is santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. And you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Right now, I would like to welcome Richard Grant. He is the author of God's Middle Finger, Into the Lawless Heart of the Sierra Madre. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Good to be here.
Now, the Sierra Madre, first of all, let's tell our listeners where this place is. Where in Mexico are you talking about?
It's in northwest Mexico. It's a mountain range that begins just south of the U.S. border and goes on for about 850 miles. And it's never really been governed in a proper sense. It's always been a kind of a lawless refuge for bandits and outlaws, and also for Tarahumara Indians and Huichol Indians. And I guess modern civilization hasn't really got there in its usual form.
And when you talk about a refuge for bandits and outlaws, I mean, we're even talking about people from the United States who this place was just too governed for some people, and they went to the Sierra Madre.
Yeah, there's a long tradition of American outlaws and thieves and killers going down there. In fact, I met a guy down there who'd killed his wife's divorce attorney and was working for the drug cartels down there.
Good heavens.
He came to a bad end, though, I discovered.
So here you are saying, let me go to the most lawless place in the Western Hemisphere. What was it, a place that gives, the kind of place that of anarchy that gives anarchy a bad name? This is one quote in your book. Why on earth would you want to put yourself into this environment?
I didn't think it's not the most lawless place in the Western Hemisphere, I don't think. I just found it a very fascinating place. I mean, it's spectacularly beautiful for one thing. You've got these dramatic canyons. There's four of them deeper than the Grand Canyon, and six others nearly as deep. And and you've got Indian tribes that haven't really been assimilated. You've still got kind of gold prospectors riding around on mules, and but what you also have is a great deal of drug production, marijuana, opium. The opium gets refined into heroin, and that is the economy of the modern day Sierra Madre. But the way the drug trade works there, it has a kind of magical realist aspect to it. The drug traffickers have their own patron saint, and there's hitmen bring their bullets to the shrines to get them blessed. And the whole thing just had a kind of, I guess a sort of magical realist feel to me.
It's funny, there's a place in the book where you talk about being really a very non-religious person and saying that the kind of logical British common sense attitude that you have was just inadequate to understand the surroundings that you were in.
Yeah, completely inadequate. I really realized just how limited my mindset was down there, which is a good thing, you know. I like to be wrong. I like to feel stupid.
So where was the first place you went, and what did you do?
The first place I went was about 20 miles south of Douglas, Arizona, just south and a little bit east. And I met somebody that had a ranch up there, and it was a good introduction to the Sierra Madre. The first day we had to wait 3 days. It was a cloudburst, and we had to wait for a river to subside. Then we got stuck in the mud and on the other side of the river for about a day. Then a cowboy came along on a horse, helped dig us out, and then tried to sell us a crack pipe carved out of a deer antler. Then we eventually got up to the ranch, and a mule train laden with bales of marijuana came right past us. And then the guy I was with got bucked off a mule and dragged across the rocks and nearly got killed. It's got, welcome to the Sierra Madre.
He said, oh, I want more of this. Let's go.
Well, I thought it could only get better from there.
You actually began this project knowing not a whole lot of Spanish and not knowing how to ride a horse.
That's true, yeah. I ended up going to a Spanish immersion school for a month in Guadalajara. And, Guanajuato. And that sort of picked up my Spanish a bit. But I found that the Spanish they spoke up there in the mountains was very different to what they were speaking in central Mexico. And I took some horse riding lessons. And there's only two paved roads that cross the whole mountain range, the whole 850-mile mountain range. So in the backcountry, there's still a lot of people getting around on horses and mules.
So One of the things that you write about in the book is the Apache Indians, who were really what, I mean, it's sort of cliche, but wild Indians in the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, I mean, we think the Apaches were sort of brought to heel in, I think it was 1886, the surrender of Geronimo. But in the Sierra Madre, there were some that never came in and were still raiding and taking captives and running off livestock in the 1920s and 1930s. There was a couple of raids on ranches in New Mexico in the late 1920s, and eventually the Mexicans pretty much hunted them out and killed them. But there were some interesting stories I came across of captive children, captive Apache children. There's one of them. She was sort of snatched by Mexican. The Mexicans go out there and hunt Apaches, basically, but they rescued this children, and she wound up going to high school in this little girl. She went to high school in California, and she ended up living in Italy. And she kept the little buckskin dress that her Apache grandmother had sewn for her and died with it in Italy.
And there's all sorts of really violent stories of, people being raped and killed and stolen from each other and so on.
Yeah, I mean, it's when you don't have law brought in by the government, I think this is probably true in most places of the world, you kind of get a strong vengeance culture and a tradition of settling differences through violence. And I think it's sort of comparable to the interior of Sicily, the Mafia Hills of Sicily, or the Hindu Kush, you know, the tribal areas in northwest Pakistan. From what I've read about there, it's sort of, there's some similarities regarding vengeance and a love of guns and a clannishness. I think if Osama bin Laden was a Mexican, I think I know exactly where he'd be.
Well, then you also have the question of the police. I mean, this is the, and the military, so this is a great drug-producing area, and the drug mafia have a whole lot more power than the armed forces.
Yeah, I mean, what you find is that where there are police, they're usually, they're not just corrupt, they're actively working for the mafia.
Right.
I mean, I had police officers trying to sell me kilos, trying to sell me a rocket-propelled grenade launcher for shooting down helicopters.
Right. And there you are, the Englishman saying, well, I don't need to shoot down any helicopters.
Well, they told me it would be good for bandits, too. Bandits are another problem in some parts of the Sierra. The army is a more complicated question. The army are going in there. That's basically how the government expresses its authority is through the army. And sometimes they do cut down crops. Sometimes apparently they do actually destroy the crops they cut down. But most people say that, you know, more often they'll sell what they cut down, or we get one drug lord will bribe an army unit to go cut down his rival's crop. But the army is a problem for the growers, and people, you know, do get arrested by the army.
We're talking to Richard Grant. The book is called God's Middle Finger, Into the Lawless Heart of the Sierra Madre. There's also a whole colony of Mormons in the Sierra Madre. How did they get there, and what are their lives like now?
Yeah, they have this expression that people go to the Sierra Madre for their health, which basically means to get away from the law. And this was the case with the Mormons when polygamy was outlawed here. A few hundred polygamous Mormons went down into the mountains in Chihuahua and set up polygamist colonies. Most of them have now disavowed polygamy, and most of them have kind of come down into the foothills, but there are still a few pockets of polygamous Mormons up there.
And what are their lives like? Do they speak English? Are they assimilated Mexicans?
They're sort of an interesting cross between the two, and then they're all sort of fluently bilingual, as you'd expect. And compared to the Mormons up here, they have more of a kind of swagger to them, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, yeah.
They've picked up some of that Norteño and Mexican swagger, and they have a more irreverent attitude towards authority and life in general than the Mormons I've met here.
And what do they actually do there? What is their economy?
Farming, mainly. Yeah, they raise fruit, and, a lot of them have got caught growing pot up there, too. They talk about it.
When in Rome.
Exactly.
So
the economics are hard to resist.
So you went from place to place, and one of the things that's so interesting is you can't just sort of you know, show up with your credit card and stay at the Motel 6. I mean, you have to be accompanied, and it's sort of, it's almost biblical. You know, I know so-and-so, the son of so-and-so. That's how, that's sort of your visiting card.
Yeah, you need to get someone from there to take you in, and it's, if you've got the right guide, it's actually quite safe to travel around anywhere if you're with the right person that everyone knows. But what you get on the roads is every time you meet somebody on a road, whether you're on a horse or in a truck, you stop and people kind of exchange their clan credentials. You know, I am the friend of, you know, the father of your cousin. You know, I know your son, and it's a slightly tense encounter every time, because they don't want outsiders blundering around in their territory. They're very territorial up in the backcountry there.
And the murder rate in certain places in the Sierra Madre is very, very high.
Yes, I was in southern Sonora. It's hard to get reliable statistics, but there was this one county in southern Sonora, well, municipality, but it's basically a kind of agricultural county. Population 10,000, averaging 90 to 100 murders a year, which is about 8 times the worst ghetto in America.
And why is this? What's going on there?
Well, the main reason, I think, and people say it's because of the drugs, but the main reason is because it's such a vengeance culture. And the drugs basically bring in money. Before drugs, these people were subsistence ranchers and farmers, a little bit of mining. Drugs brought in money, and the money gets spent on guns, alcohol, and cocaine. So things get volatile, and people get killed over stupid things, but every one of those killings has to get avenged by the victim's family. And if they can't, yeah, it's kind of blood for blood. If you can't get the killer himself, his brother will do. So you get a lot of feuding going on. And then, you add narcotics trade to a vengeance culture, and your murder rate increases.
Now, for you, going through the Sierra Madre, meeting people, talking to them, one of the things that you have to do is accept whatever they give you, food, drink. I mean, if you want to do a whole lot of drinking, go to the Sierra Madre, is what it sounds like.
It's a drunken place. It really is. It's probably the most drunken place I've ever been. I mean, I come from England, which is a pretty drunken place, but it's... One of the reasons that people get killed is refusing to drink with a man is often taken as an insult to his honor. It's actually a very interesting book just written on this subject about why and how people get killed, and it turns out to be incredibly common. A guy went and interviewed all the killers that had been arrested.
In the Sierra Madre?
Yeah, I mean, they were in prisons around the Sierra Madre, and time and again, it's like, the man refused to drink with me, so I shot him. And the other thing he found is there's very little remorse amongst the killers. They all thought they'd either killed out of vengeance or honor, and they thought they'd done the right thing.
So when somebody offered you a drink, that was that?
Well, yes, I ended up doing a lot of drinking down there.
And sometimes there was one scene, I think it was with some policemen, they wanted you to drink with them, and then they wanted you to pay.
Yeah, well, I was just called over to this table and asked to sit down. And then it turned out to be two policemen. They were really high on cocaine as well, and they just kept ordering drinks and looking at me to pay. And then they kind of cornered me in the bathroom and shoved a knife under my nose with cocaine and said, "Snort." So I did. And then I didn't know whether they were going to arrest me or set me up.
Yeah, because that could be a setup to frame you.
Right, it's very complicated. It's like, you don't want anyone to think you're a DEA agent, so I thought, well, if I snort the drugs, they'll know I'm not a DEA agent, but then on the other hand, they might be trying to set me up. So I snorted off the cocaine off the knife, and then I turned to leave, and they went like, "No, no, no," and I was like, "Oh, here it comes," but then they just said, "You must do the other nostril, it's very important." So
you, what did you tell people you were? I mean, you couldn't say I'm a journalist, because that's a red flag.
God, no.
So you said you were a historian?
A lot of the times I presented myself as a historian.
And how'd that go over?
Not well. I thought it was a good idea. It sounds harmless and tweedy. But a lot of people had no idea what a historian would be doing there. It sounded really suspicious. And in fact, it went a lot easier when people assumed I was there to buy drugs, because that made more sense to them. Or, you know, why else would he come up here?
So then you let people think that?
At times, yeah. I mean, it depended. I mean, some people, you know, I told them I was going to write a book, and I was a little vague about what the book was about. I tried not to look too interested when they talked about drugs, but that's kind of what people end up talking about.
In places like the places you went, you have to, your animal instincts, for lack of a better word, have to be really on high alert, and you have to be aware of your surroundings all the time, and who's safe and who's not safe. And I mean, there's one time where you went toward the end, it's actually the incident that got you to end your stay. You looked at some people and you could tell immediately that they were predators.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't hard to tell. I mean, they just looked at me like a great big pork chop that just landed on their plate, and it was just, their eyes were glittering. And the first question they asked me was, "So you're here alone and unarmed?"
But could you tell right away they wanted to kill you?
Well, they wanted to. I wasn't sure whether they wanted to rob me or kill me, but I just knew I was in bad trouble. All my alert systems were flashing red, but it was hard to get out of there.
So you stayed and drank with them?
Well, I did, yeah. I thought that was my best option, was to try and make friends with them, which is what I was desperately trying to do. And they were sort of offering me a beer, and so I wasn't going to refuse that.
Right.
But it turned into a very frightening night. They basically ended up hunting me through the woods. They had a big truck, and they got two other guys with flashlights, and I was sort of running and hiding.
And you succeeded in outwitting them.
Well, thankfully, they were completely drunk and eventually passed out, and I was able to get away. But that was my kind of last night in the Sierra. I just lost my nerve after that.
Now, before all that happened, there's a little interlude where you found somebody whose, was it his father or grandfather, had had a lot of gold and had hidden it, and they were trying to find out where it was, and you got involved in this whole gold treasure hunting thing, which brought out a part of you that you didn't even know was there.
Yeah, it was actually a Mormon that I was traveling with. His father had been a doctor and had become friends with this American bank robber who'd robbed a big bank shipment and had lived among the Mormons and had always paid it for everything with gold and silver American coins. And right before he died, the bandit told the doctor where he'd buried his main stash. And the doctor had sort of dragged him off his deathbed and rushed up to the mountain, but a fire had gone through there and things looked a little bit different to how the bank robber remembered it. And the doctor had always sworn to go back up there and with a metal detector, but he never had. And then his son had been meaning to do it for years, the guy who was showing me around, and I persuaded him that we should do this. So I went and found a professional treasure hunter with a metal detector, and we went up there, and we had a good description of the site. But before we went up there, I'd said, you know, I don't even want a share of the gold, I just want the experience. But once we were up there digging, I sort of came down with a mild case of gold fever, and I decided that I definitely wanted my share, and that these other guys were trying to swindle me out of it, and the guy was,
and everybody felt that way,
and everyone felt that way. It was just like the movie, the Treasure of the Sierra Madre. Everyone became incredibly suspicious of each other and kind of cranky, and by the end of it, well, we were still talking to each other, but there was like an unspoken tension.
And you never found the treasure?
No, sadly.
So we're talking to Richard Grant. The book is called God's Middle Finger, Into the Lawless Heart of the Sierra Madre. And by the way, Richard spoke yesterday at Garcia Street Books, where this book is available. And it's wonderfully written, I have to say. It's just delightful and gripping to read, just from one page to another. You met an environmentalist there named Randy Gingrich, who was defending old-growth forests against the pro-logging forces. Tell us that whole story.
Well, it's a kind of long and complicated story, but Randy is, working with an outfit called the Sierra Madre Alliance that's been trying to protect old-growth forests and indigenous rights, particularly the Tarahumara and the Tepehuan Indians that live down there. And it's really been a difficult struggle for them. I think partly because they kind of expect Mexican legal and governmental systems to work more like they do up here, and they keep getting thwarted by sort of crooked judges and laws that aren't enforced
and goon squads.
And yeah, we encountered a goon squad up there. They were the kind of prologging goons. They were mainly Tepehuans and Tarahumaras that were prologging, because things are never that simple. You know, a lot of Tarahumaras want to log their forest, but they want the money from it.
Yeah,
Tarahumaras are against the logging.
I mean, people like these, you know, liberal environmentalists want to frame it as the good, peaceful Native American Indian against the evil corporate interests, but it isn't that way.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's more complicated than that. Yeah, and I mean, there's been a lot of horrendous violence committed against Indians down there by, a lot of times the logging guy is also a drug guy. They kind of had these narco timber barons down there, and certainly in the 80s they were forcing Indians to grow. They would cut down the forest and then force the Tarahumaras to grow drugs on the cleared land, and a lot of Tarahumaras got killed. And that was how the whole thing was framed for a while. But now, of course, a lot of Tarahumaras are growing opium and marijuana themselves of their free will. And it's a nice little business for them. Well, they see it as a way to, you know, the only way they can stay on their land and make a living. But of course, you can't really tell that to donors on this side of the line.
Right. And, I mean, it is such an interesting thing to see the frustration of, you know, white gringo liberals confronted with this incredibly complicated semi-lawless system where, I mean, for example, there's an injunction against logging and they just don't care. They just go ahead and log anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Mexico is just so much more complicated. The layers of sort of corruption and contradiction. It's hard for us to get our heads around. Hard for me, hard for activists. It's just the whole fabric of reality just seems a little bit different down there, and the version of reality that we subscribe to is different.
I suppose it's, in some ways, even though at moments it's scary and confusing, it's sort of also refreshing, you know, coming from kind of corporate monoculture, predictable USA life.
Well, exactly, and that's one of the main reasons why I wanted to explore this place. Just as, I mean, we kind of think that sort of Google knows everything, but you Google the Sierra Madre and almost nothing comes up, you know. It just kind of made me realize just how big and strange and puzzling the world still is.
Did you come away feeling like you'd figured some things out?
Yeah, I mean, sort of pathetically small amount of what was there, but I came out knowing more than when I went in. I mean, I still feel like I just barely scratched the surface of what's there.
Would you go back?
I would go back to some areas. I would go back to the Copper Canyon area, which is safe for tourists to visit.
Tell us that story, why the Copper Canyon is safe for tourists to visit.
Well, because the drug guys are in favor of tourism there. In 1990, well, all through the 1990s, the Copper Canyon train, which is the main way that tourists get in there, was getting robbed by bandits. And in 1994, seven bandits boarded the train, and a Swiss man was videotaping them. He thought it was a staged entertainment, according to some witnesses. He thought the bandits were part of a bandit show because they were real bandits, and they shot him and they killed him and his wife and somebody else. And every one of those seven bandits was hunted down and executed by the drug mafia. And the message was sent throughout the Copper Canyon area, you don't mess with the tourists. A lot of the drug guys are laundering money through the tourism hotels. Everybody's in favor of tourism down there. It brings in money and it doesn't really disturb the drug trade, and there's an interesting kind of peaceful coexistence there.
And the tourists are blissfully oblivious to the drug trade all around them.
Tourists have no idea, and the guides lead them carefully around the marijuana fields and keep them out of the dangerous places, and yeah, it works very well.
Richard Grant is the author of God's Middle Finger Into the Lawless Heart of the Sierra Madre. And unfortunately, it's time to leave. There was one more question that I did want to ask you, though, which is, we were sort of talking about this a little before we went on the air. What do you think that the legalization of drugs, which a lot of people are fighting for, although it doesn't look imminent, would do to a place like the Sierra Madre?
Well, yeah, I mean, we're definitely into the hypothetical here. I don't think it's a political reality here yet, but I think it would be a disaster. Mexico, it's Mexico's biggest industry. It's $50 billion at the best estimate, maybe more.
And virtually all export.
Yeah, $50 billion. It's Mexico's biggest export is drugs. And if you took that $50 billion a year out of the Mexican economy, it would be absolute mayhem. I think drug money is one of the few things holding Mexico together at the moment.
Very interesting. Well, thank you very much for being with us here. The book is God's Middle Finger. Oh, one more thing before. Why God's Middle Finger?
There was a statue of God at the Tarahumara Easter festivities that I went to. And he was holding up his hand, and his hand was turned outward. And over the years, all his fingers had broken off apart from the middle one. So it kind of looked like God was flipping the bird. And then if you look at a map, you could, with the right set of eyes, you could look at the Sierra Madre. It looks like a bit of a finger sticking up here.
Richard Grant, thank you so much for spending
this
time with us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte.
We are going to take a little break right now. Stay tuned to KSFR. I'd like now to welcome Kentro Lodro Taye Rinpoche. He is visiting us in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe. And his translator Paloma is with us. Thank you for being here.
It's a pleasure.
So let's talk about the word dharma. What does the word dharma mean?
Oh yeah, tani dharma jipati ton de kare ze khore ze na ne. Tani chubi ton ta ne. Kyopi ton te ni kala tani no khore. Kare ze re ze na ne. Kon dharma jipati lam ti go ni. Tani nyamsulembi goni ne sem kanang ni tani nyumo bi dungar ke tsawa dungar ke ju tani fang ni ju ni tak sem tendur ni ti top ki tani dungar li chop ro kyo pa de ti mangla tani dharma ji pa te tela je ki ore se tani nang la gum gum gya ya tang cha chang ma tani nang la yo re tani re se.
So Rinpoche said the dharma, if we look at the meaning, it has the etymological meaning has a twofold sense, and one of a transformation or change that takes place, and the other as the protection. And what that means, when we talk about dharma, it's a path that is practiced, and through practicing that, and then what we're doing is we're transforming all of our disturbing and afflictive emotions, and we're transforming all of those actions and afflictions that are the causes for suffering. And so we have transformation, or change, taking place through our practice, and in the taming of the mind in that way, and then as we stop engaging in the causes of suffering, we're protected from the result, suffering itself, and so there's also the sense of protection. So when we talk about Buddhist dharma, that's the sense.
So we talk in Buddhist practice about the eradication of suffering. Is that possible, and for all sentient beings? How is that possible when most sentient beings can't practice dharma, like dogs and cats and mice and so on?
Hakaso ni konto dungal tsawa ne meba zoba gikeche yoreze gdu nangbe chuluk na ngado miksel tani semchen tamchet gdungal meba zoba di kante chiksiki yore kanyan sena shimi dan ki dan den konto nyamna che chogu mando.
Tendi re, tani tate ngatsu tani nyamlin patnam ki ne sem kanala mulam tatang tana tani shamba tang nyangji goni rjan la rjan ki che to mulam tatang thamche dungar li tharwa tang thamche dewa chik dam bi che to mulam ma chu tap khyo re yin na yang tani nguni tani tendo khahi kana la yo sekre hwe na tendo kana la gyam so chem bu na la mi sem ra wa ha chang ga sar bu yin khan ga tani tendo khahi yo te de chu yin na fang sha kang yin lang sha kang yin shit bi shit control la habna control gyan tam kan yore nyong nyong yore tam che ke thab gare dina na ba kon da thab ko mar won chang tani khoy na na sang di pi log la na yitak tang tenro yin chang lusten zhen de deni jeo yap ni ne deni keba je ni mi lusten len ro wa tang de khirp chang ke lusten len ro yir ni kap na kontu bian ko khyore nga tu ti go ni deni sam lo tang khyore ze ti ti go ni sam lo tang ni deni tham che dung ar di tor wa chik chung o thup sam ya tang de chik deb jin to ne deni nyam nen khan te chu yin na sang maung ba na konso sang gi tang shang chup sen khri ni tu jur song yin ni kap na Tani mulam yore konso kipupsi ni ngaso devapsi ni topso tandik dukze yomar Samshin tamche tap gandur ki goni ni Tani dungar sevi tabla ni tani shekhi yore tukkacha tere eze
So there's a lot in that question there And on the one hand, yes, as practitioners then we're constantly making prayers and aspirations For the welfare of all sentient beings And cultivating love and compassion and engaging in actions to help alleviate suffering and bring them happiness and especially making aspiration prayers that eventually all living beings will be completely freed from suffering and find a state of ultimate happiness and so there's a lot of prayer and so forth that's our goal that's what we want and for the most part it is true that in their present circumstances with the exception of maybe some very rare sentient beings they talk about some mythical beings in the ocean and so forth that but for the most part then animals do not have the intelligence to receive teachings and engage in the actions that eliminate the causes of suffering and thus find happiness in the course of this life but from the Buddhist perspective then there are more than one lifetime and so then though right now they might be born in a hungry ghost realm or an animal realm and so forth eventually those circumstances will change and they may have through certain causes and conditions the opportunity to be born into an intelligent life such as humans and to meet with a path in which they can be liberated from suffering and find happiness. Also, when we engage in the practice, the ultimate goal is the state of Buddhahood or of a bodhisattva, a saint. And the point is for the welfare of others. So it's not like we're just trying to help ourselves and we get there and we can just hang out real happy and now everything's okay, but actually that we're looking at then that greater potential of then engaging in the actions of benefiting others, of helping others to tame their minds and be able to free themselves in these ways.
What is the role of faith in Buddhism? Is there a religious faith or belief that is necessary, or is it all about practice of the Dharma?
It's a very good question. Thank you. Tani nawa santi pilugla ne santi rani ki kari songre zena ne chakche darvi se jintel ne par tak langa ikwa langar sha ikushir men songne ne tani kari songre zena ne zowu tapate tani gimtsin ki goni Hini ne, then Yichi Kiva Timalana, Yichi Pitapa, the Hure, not to Turto Shekhure. Then he turts over it, and he now has Hanji Pilulan, Jimson Hippigoni, Tapa Doya, the Te Gregoson. Tipshana Sanji Kayana, Sangi Pay Yapore, Tamshekananim Shok to Kurari, Tipshana, then his Hanji Gilapsa Tamshet, the Dembare, Capson Dogo, Congo Karelamna, Terese, any Mompita Pigoni, then he keep Lango Mundo. When Naxer Yang Tapachik Yinguna, Tani Rumbab Gentone, Tani Consulse La Tarsian Sapachinine, Tarser Yang Tapa, Tani Shonga Gentone, Tani Conco, Carrison and Anna Sandi Pilublayan, Keran to Tani, Ate, Sapachinine, Jimson Gigoni, Tani Nipakeni Yamnishina, Dikrio also.
So that's a very good question. Oh, he said that in English. Anyways. In the Buddhist tradition, Rinpoche said, then the Buddha himself, he said, like gold that goes through a careful process of purification and refinement, then examine my words well, do not accept them out of mere respect. And he encouraged us then to examine and investigate, to find through our own logical process and our own experience that what he taught was true. And so faith in Tibetan Buddhism is not one that is just based on a blind faith, a belief in something without logic. It's ideally actually a confident belief that comes through our investigation and examination that we arrive at logically and experientially to that something that we come to we know to be true. from that process. And so the Buddhist ideal kind of faith is that kind of faith, one based in logic and reasoning. And so the Buddha, he said, don't just accept my words because I'm a Buddha and Buddhas are supposed to be exalted and so forth, but then just that we have to believe it, that it, everything that they say is true and take refuge in them and so forth. Blind faith is not necessary, he said. And that's the example is like gold. Gold goes through a gradual process of purification or refinement from smelting and so forth onward. And so too, he said, like gold, examine my words well. Examine them to find the truth yourself. And so the kind of faith that is most encouraged is one based on logic and reasoning and our own investigation.
So the doctrine of reincarnation, first of all, how does the reincarnation work? And also, is that something that you have come to yourself through a process of reasoning and discovery, or is it something you have to believe in?
How goes it? Di yangir yangir kewala di kante chigin kerang taksing chene samling eba chongsong yangmena kemong be tepa tik kelang song kanyan sana nang be chulup nangere.
Yeah. Tani tela tani shirtang tani ngatsu tani nawa sangji piluk lana tani sangji ki tani gemsam shokchik ni sangji ki tani yopar tani song yore kewa tani yin kewa ngapshi yoze tani song yore shokchik tere shok ni ni kare re zena na tani nawa sangji piluk lana ngubu ni lukla takshang shapap shi sona hamchit tani nanga semtang na tani ti yur hamchit zonwa tam zimba hamchit ngachu ngola nang khyo pa thong khyo pa tham che te gi kin tem dir la ten ni tem dir go ni tham che te phyong are ngu bu ni lup tang tham bi go ni phyong gu na ta ni a gim chen ki go ni chang na ke wa nga ma yo pr te pa te ta ni ngachu na sang ji bi de la dbi ay ore won chang ta ni hob jong yak po chik ta ni phie go go ti ko la hob jong phie go na ngachu mixer ke chap ma je ti nang la gim chen ji go ni Tani bembo bembo ni kandepsi ni pshong khunduk, hiba hiba ni karepsi ni pshong khunduk, hiba li bembo dupsi ni pshong otap, bembo ni hiba ngu ni pshong otap matap, tani nga tsu teh takshang shia papshi gona kansam chikla kondwa ya yore, ta tani gimtsan ni re. Taib jen ta gimtsan samba tani zowu tani tangsang tani nzambu langla na, bugu mambu tani kiawa ngu ni tangki yong khan, tayang huay na jiga Pama de to Duncan Dugzeni, Kunsu Kala Yambat and Mimbana, Jungo, Takshan Shepi, Tokpa Mixer, Tuknina, then if Demba Muni Yimbate, then he Halepit, then he Pogor Tonchama Botany, Zambulan La Deptoniore, the Namasanji Bilula Muni and Songyore, Kiva Nama Duncan Yo, Tuchikpoka Hako Tokre, is it?
Yes, sir.
Or a teacher Nangato, Kiva Napshi, Dumkin, Dupshik, Rippat, or Gimson Hajamapore, your mara, then you drip gunner Gimson Yom, Yerufa Nato, Mumi, your Pachik, your mara. Or a Tigoni, the Hako Grese.
So there are several things I could talk about here. One is that, to a certain degree, it's something that the Buddha saw. It, through his own wisdom and was able to talk about past and future lives. And then secondly, that within that tradition there is all kinds of lines of reasoning or logic that we can examine. Examining the inner mind as our subjective experience, examining outer objects as the outer environment, this whole examination of subjective, objective, dualistic perception and everything that arises to our perceptions has been examined very carefully. And one of the main sort of thrusts of the teaching is that everything is interdependently occurring. That is, it's occurring dependent upon causes and contributing conditions. And here, then in this specific case of reincarnation, of being born again and so forth, it's an examination of the way things are according to our basic reality in the logic on how things can and do come about. And so there is actually a logical basis and many very fine and subtle lines of reasoning that can be studied that establish that there is past and future lives. And this is called valid cognition or tema in Tibetan. And it's we look at the mind as being conscious matter, is what it's called, versus unconscious matter, like inanimate matter cells and so forth. And the question is then, what comes from what? If everything's interdependently occurring and the causes are similar to the effects, then some of the reasoning is that consciousness comes from consciousness and inanimate matter comes from inanimate matter. Could inanimate matter come from consciousness? Could consciousness come from inanimate matter? And so there's this very thorough investigation of the possibilities and what comes from what causes what effects. So that's another reason. A third is that these days many children have been found who have remembered their past lives. And we're not just talking about they say it, but that the governments and people have come in and examined and so forth and found that what they've, their stories and so on have been true. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, and there have been books that are written on them and so forth. So that's another reason. And the Buddha himself, he said there are many beings to remember past lifetimes, and that in and of itself is a direct, you know, relationship and one of the proofs that we can look at. And so on the one hand, we can examine and find many reasons why there would be reincarnation, past and future lives, but there are not so many logical reasons that can actually completely disprove it without a doubt.
We're talking to Khenpo Lodro Taye Rinpoche. What is the Tibetan understanding of what happens during the death process and after a person dies?
So, of course, that would take a lot of discussion. But Rinpoche said basically it's a discussion on the experience that we consciously go through as we die, because through the dying process then our consciousness and all of our faculties are gradually fading, and we'll step one by one until finally there's this the last aspect is our mind of kind of an obvious or perceptible aspect of consciousness, which also fades into a less perceptible aspect of consciousness. And so it's a lengthy explanation of what we feel as we die and how then to relate to that. And the perspective is that that process of dying is very much connected to our process of living and our conscious experience, and that we should all prepare for death. And in preparing for it, then we can know what to expect and we can die with ease and without fear and without, without doubt and so forth. And so there are very lengthy explanations on how to prepare for death, how to go through the process of dying, and also what happens after we die with the consciousness and so forth. And in preparing for it, it helps to alleviate a lot of the fears and anxieties that we have. And so as someone alive, it's kind of like our responsibility also to learn how to die, not just how to live. And so there are many teachings and if we understand that process of dying, it brings greater insight in how to work with ourselves while we're living, how to live, how to use this human life well, and so forth. So they're very integrally very much related. And so also how to help other people die and so forth. And this isn't just Tibetan custom alone, or that it's just one tradition so much as it's more an examination of the actual process that we go through, which is kind of common across the board for everyone, and how to work with that as it comes.
Now, you're teaching a workshop this Saturday and Sunday from 9 to 5 all day on Saturday and Sunday at the end of the Alameda. It's called Cutting Through the Four Attachments. Mm-hmm. What are the four attachments?
So the first of these is the attachment to what we call samsara, which is our cyclic existence, you could say ordinary experience. And so it's an examination of the way in which we, the word actually for attachment here has a sense of almost like obsessive fixation or grasping. And what does that do for us? We have too much attachment to our temporary, ordinary experience, how that affects us and how it affects our actions. And so then the first attachment is the attachment to samsara. The jemba korwa la jena karere di dochok.
Okay.
And so that's the first that we're working with. The second is that the path is based on benefiting others and selfless altruism, love and compassion. And oftentimes we talk about benefiting others and we talk about love and compassion, but it's not yet pure because it's still very much mixed with our own self-interests and our attachments to ourselves and what we're getting out of that helping. And so it says where there is attachment to others, there isn't a true, pure, I mean, where there is attachment to oneself, there isn't a pure concern for the welfare of others. And so it's learning how to decipher that attachment to ourselves versus genuine altruism and wish to benefit others. So that's the second one.
Oh yeah, there. Then he somebody made a car is in a car while a jenna nim jong man.
Do you kind of tanda ke?
Oh, mara mara, te mara. Then he zimbab shona tawa man zere. Te car is in a gum kateni zapo chik teni fiakiore. Then he gum.
So then the third is where there is a fixation or grasp. Fixation or perception in terms of a subject and object, there is no authentic view. And this is a very profound explanation on the profound level of meditation, which is meditation on the way things are, the ultimate nature of phenomena, what is timelessly and has always been. And this true nature of all things is what we want to realize. And it is beyond, it transcends our ordinary conceptual mind. We always think in terms of a subject and an object. So our mind is grasping to, you could say, or fixating, perceiving in terms of objective appearances. So we have this very dual experience that is always conceptualized in terms of self and other and so forth. And it says where there is that grasping, where is that reification or fixation, there isn't an authentic view of what is. And so it's pointing out that differentiation there. And second
one, that's the third one?
That's the third one. And the fourth one is, maybe it's in here. I don't know what I'm saying.
Yeah.
That's okay.
Okay.
I think for the ordinary person, self and other is normal. I'm sitting here, you're sitting there. I'm not you, you're not me. How do you understand that on a deeper level?
That's
not true. tani zonzen ge goni de kunzup ge wang tshi na ne nga chu zong wa tang zen ba kyo pa ka nga tsa ka shi ni nga chu zong khyo le won jang ton tam bi ni lu ku wang tshi na ngo mi tani kyo ge ni lu ka re re ngi ni lu ka re ngi zen ba ka re re chun zen ba ka re re ti ni lu tsal song na ne tani ka ka la che khyo re ti ni lu ton tam ba ni tong ya yo re ti shir na nga chu di den chak ka la ne gum gya pi tang en zen kir kor tang khirep kir kor tang tani tam che tani yak po chik tani Dendi Zafem Bata Himala Yakpochi Gungureze.
So that is what characterizes our relative experience, is in terms of these conceptual thoughts that are always fixating, in terms of thinking, you're there, I'm here, over there, over here. And that is what we talk about as being relative truth. It's kind of the nature of our relative reality. However, we're looking at here what is ultimately the case. What is the true nature of your mind? What is the true nature of my mind? And when we examine that true nature, it's not different. And it is transcends this ordinary experience that thinks in terms the way in which we grasp to things. And so this weekend, over the couple of days, I'll be clarifying that view and understanding of meditation and profound levels of meditative absorption, and also that wisdom that transcends ordinary mind's experience in that way.
Khenchul Lodro Taye Rinpoche, thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can reach me at the email radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to listen, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Laurel Reynolds for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. Tomorrow is Friday. Robert Knott will be with us. Lots of other good stuff, too, so stay tuned to Santa Fe's only public radio station, KSFR. Hasta la vista. Bye.